Hi, it's Julia Hartley Brewer here, and I can't wait to join Brendan O'Neill for a special live recording of his podcast. And you can be there too. It's on Wednesday, 22nd of September at 7 p.m. Tickets cost just £5, or if you're a Spiked supporter, you can get your ticket for free. So get your tickets now before they're all gone. Just go to spiked-online.com/events to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Spiked podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and with me this week, as ever, we have Spiked's deputy editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And Spiked columnist, Ella Whelan.
Hi.
Coming up on the show, Boris's cabinet reshuffle, Insulate Britain, Emma Raducanu and AOC at the Met Gala. So Boris has finally done a reshuffle. He's pretty much kept the whole of his team since before the pandemic. A lot of the kind of deadwood has been clinging on for dear life. Tom, what moves have really stood out for you in this?
Well, it was definitely more drastic than I think anyone else was expecting. I mean, it was long overdue insofar as you say, there were a lot of people who kind of ended up with a bit of stay of execution because of the fact of the pandemic, in some cases, because of their, you know, implication in the broader policy, I guess. I mean, Matt Hancock could quite conceivably still be there if he hadn't shown his own way out as a result of his affair when the pressure got too much. But yes, people like Gavin Williamson were obviously up for the chop for a very long time. I feel the tiniest bit bad for him insofar as, you know, he was basically made to carry the can for a policy in relation to schools that he often didn't really have much involved in making. You know? I mean, it was really the kind of the so-called quad of ministers of Gove, of Johnson, Sunak and the health secretary, depending on who that was at any one time, who were really making the decisions. But if you look at his gaffes throughout his, you know, ministerial career, telling Russia to go away and shut up, being in the middle of that Huawei leak, allegedly, all of these different things. I mean, you can't help but feel, as many of his detractors say, that it was purely because he used to be chief whip and he knows where the bodies were buried, that he was still sticking around. But nevertheless, there's a few more interesting ones in there, I guess. I think the nod being given to Liz Truss, obviously Dominic Raab being demoted after the whole Kabul debacle, reflects how increasingly her stock is kind of rising, particularly in Tory circles. She kind of tops the Con Home polls regularly at the moment. She's the only one who's really been able to get on and crack on with things in the midst of the pandemic, all these rollover trade deals and all the rest of it. But I think the Gove being moved to housing, but also sorting out levelling up, is also quite interesting insofar as what we're really seeing there is an attempt to try and get a kind of post-pandemic legacy and vision together. Because so far, you know, we've been told that it's going to be about levelling up, but at the same time, that's really remained a slogan. So just sending in who is seen as their kind of most efficient sort of minister to go in there and give that project a little bit of meaning. So yes, a lot of deadwood cleared, it probably should have been cleared a long time ago, but this is a kind of point in which you realize that the government still is thrashing around for what it is for, really, at the end of the day, and trying to revisit that after all of that naturally being put on hold for the past 18 months.
And that is the question at the heart of it. It's something, you know, people are forever trying to determine what Boris is all about. And do we have a clearer sense of that from this, do you think, Ella?
No, I don't think so, unsurprisingly, because, I mean, the most shocking changes were the ones that were inevitable and obvious, like Raab being punished for his holiday away and Gavin Williamson being ditched. And then people like Jenrick with the whole West Ferry scandal, that being an obvious demotion. But the thing that tells you that there's nothing is really changing, I think, is actually the Gove promotion. Because if you look at what's happening today outside Parliament, there's a protest led by leaseholders in relation to the cladding scandal. You know, UK housing is an absolute shit show from top to bottom, not just in terms of the lack of housing, but also the way in which the government is dealing with housing, the cladding scandal being an example of that. That's Jenrick's legacy. And I think what Gove's being sent in to do is not be innovative in the many ways that we've talked about the need for housing to be innovative on this podcast, not to have any kind of big ideas about infrastructure, but to kind of settle the disquiet that's going on. One of the big concerns for the Tories will be the fact that they have all this focus on the red wall and they've got their blue wall grumbling away, being concerned about primarily planning and housing and NIMBY-ish kind of desires to stop things from being built in their backyard. And I think that is also what's going to be Gove's role. So it's all very safe. There's been a kind of discussion about the ruthlessness of Boris Johnson. And actually, I don't think it has been particularly ruthless. There hasn't been any real sacrifices. All the people who are in the main jobs have stayed there, bar Dominic Raab, Priti Patel, Sajid Javid, Kwasi Kwarteng, it's quietly ticking along. The real question is not what the cabinet looks like, but what the policies are going to be, as it always is. People like to engage in the kind of gossip of a cabinet reshuffle, but there's no sign, particularly when it comes to their continuation of screwing around with COVID policy that we're going to come on to talk about, that anything really is going to change.
I mean, there's been a lot of disquiet on the Tory right, particularly since, we talked a bit about this last week, since the social care kind of package came forward, tax rising, potentially rising taxes to some of the highest levels they've been, since the war. Do these changes address any of that? Do they give us any clue as to, what direction Boris is going in on that front?
Well, certainly not in and of itself. I mean, this was, I suppose, a crossing of a line for Tory backbenchers, old-style Thatcherites, insofar as they just are attached to the identity of the party of low taxes. They're ideologically aligned with that. But it's a question of what you then do with that, really, at the end of the day. And that's where things are coming up wanting. Because as Ella was saying, there's these tensions within the new kind of Tory voter base in relation to something like levelling up. I mean, I think a lot of the complaints from kind of southern Tory seats about how they're levelling up, but they're levelling us down, these incredibly wealthy seats is utterly ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think they'll actually hold on to a lot of those places. Or if nothing else, they're more than likely to pick up eat more into the kind of red wall, if you like, and make up for any potential losses there. But it's not straightforward. I think what's interesting as well is that, again, Labour's inability to sort of respond to this.
Yeah.
Wes Streeting is a shadow cabinet minister for child poverty, which I don't think is actually an actual minister, so I don't know who he's shadowing. But nevertheless, was on the radio this morning talking about, now, of course, we're faced with a Tory government which is presiding over the highest tax burden since the war, which isn't afraid of spending. So now the question is about how that money can be spent effectively.
Yeah.
And you think they're also kind of a little bit lost.
You know,
it's just become, under Keir Starmer, quite understandably, the kind of party of performative anti-cronyism in relation to what might happen with Tory donors, etc., which is mucky but happens with many administrations, and also just picking them up when things go wrong, which doesn't seem to me to be much of an ideological response either. So yeah, there's not a lot of it across the board, it feels like.
Are you really saying that Keir Starmer's 14,000 treatises on what he stands for is not going to clarify where Labour is going? I mean, we should talk a bit about Labour. I mean, they've been found wanting throughout the pandemic. And now, even after the pandemic, it seems as if they're still struggling to find a kind of purpose or a niche or, direction.
Yeah, and there's been some in the Labour Party, some supporters, some MPs raising a bit of disquiet about the fact that, for example, Nadine Dorries got put in as cabinet minister as culture secretary, not because it might be a problem that, for example, we've had something, like 11 culture secretaries in however long. It's
not seen as the most important role.
No, but
it's famously seen as the fun job. Run around doing parkour and then you just
go to the Brit Awards.
And if you're a Tory, you just gesture meanly at the BBC from time to time.
But it is a role that has a certain amount of importance, particularly now when we're talking about the fact that the pandemic has affected that industry so seriously. You'd want someone in there with a bit of innovation, some ideas to how to kind of re-kickstart not just live music venues, but also deal with issues around sport. They've picked up on the fact that she, for example, mixed up Chuck O'Muna and Chris Eubank, and also then mixed up Ash Sarkar and Faiza Shaheen. Criticisable things, but not a kind of substantial mounting of what it is that their ideas should be about a culture secretary. There's also the fact that they, every party does this when there is a reshuffle. They moan about what the other reshuffles is and make cheap points about the fact that this doesn't really mean anything for anyone. But then equally don't give any example of what they think should be the policies of the day. I mean, we saw this with the kind of fuss around universal credit and the the righteous fuss about the cut in universal credit. Keir Starmer thinking he'd got a gotcha on Boris Johnson for saying that the £20 cut would mean that people would have to work an extra 9 hours a week, but really giving the impression that all they want was that £20 back, and not having anything, not actually saying £20 is nothing for families. This is peanuts. This is ridiculous. They're always kind of playing a low ball. It's always really lacking, in, as Tom says, in terms of ideas. And none of it is future orientated. I mean, if there is one party that doesn't want to talk about pre-pandemic world, it's the Labour Party. They want us to remain in a kind of COVID-infused political sphere for forever, it seems like.
Yeah, and we should talk very briefly about that before we move on to the next subject. I mean, the government has unveiled its winter plan. There's the sort of plan A of extending the vaccination program, but slightly more worrying is this plan B of possible vaccine passports, reintroduction of masks potentially. I mean, what have you made of that, Tom?
It just feels like there's no ability really for the government to kind of draw a line under things. Mm. We talked about that a lot, but it feels like, of course, no one's really going to be against just, you know, stressing the kind of interventions which are most effective and also have the least effect on people's lives. Things like the vaccine program, within reason, keeping that going voluntarily, of course. But nevertheless, that's the thing that's really allowed us to get a grip on all of this. Beyond that, what are we possibly supposed to do? I mean, we've talked to it about it until we're blue in the face. The complete reorganisation of public life at the drop of a hat. This kind of ongoing technocratic fiddling where if cases go up, well, maybe we'll ask people to stop coming into work. Maybe we'll stagger the school hours, or maybe this or maybe that. You just cannot sustain this in the long term. It's not only is it completely exhausting, but if you concede that we might have to do that kind of thing in the winter, then you're basically conceding we'll have to do it forever.
Yeah.
And you just would, you just wish that there was more kind of political pressure and more of a kind of political payoff almost in being a bit more honest about that and in stressing that getting back to normal is actually a good thing to do. But obviously there's no political pressure in that direction, certainly not coming from the opposition benches at the moment.
You're listening to the Spiked podcast. This is your regular reminder that our show is also available on video. You can watch the Spiked podcast every Friday on YouTube or via the Spiked website.
Now, back to the Spiked podcast.
Insulate Britain, an offshoot of Extinction Rebellion, have been blocking the M25 on multiple occasions this week, causing chaos with traffic on one of the UK's busiest roads. I mean, the tactics have got a lot of attention. They seem to have angered a lot of people. I mean, do these environmentalists actually care if they annoy people, Tom?
No, I mean, I think that's a bit the wrong question. People say, aren't you alienating people? Like, yeah. Of course they are. I mean, it's obvious. People were, you know, frustrated drivers were dragging them off of the street whilst the police were standing by and asking if they needed anything. You know, I mean, it was really quite striking. And in a way, what I think is worth sort of stressing is, we talked about it a few weeks ago, they really don't care what ordinary people think. I mean, this is really a conversation between these kinds of protesters and the kind of cultural elite that they sort of represent values-wise, and the political elite, and one's urging the other one to hurry up and usher in eco-austerity faster. That's basically what's going on here.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because obviously Extinction Rebellion, its various offshoots, have this whole kind of philosophy of civil disobedience and all the rest of it. And I'm obviously not against civil disobedience in and of itself. But on the one hand, the thing that would sustain it is a level of popular support. Yeah. Otherwise, it is just stopping you going to work for a reason that you can barely understand and is often completely overblown. And the other thing is, you know, what are they being rebellious for? And as we know, it's just to immiserate the country, effectively. So I think kind of asking you about the questions of tactics and all the rest of it just kind of gets away from the fact that ultimately, they're not really in the business of convincing people, because I don't think you could convince the broader British public of the wisdom of making their lives worse, which is basically what they want to do.
Yeah, and you alluded to this briefly, Tom, but you know, there was something very strange about the kind of police reaction. And now none of us are in favour of the police beating up protesters or, you know, roughing them up or anything like that. But it is strange just how gently they have been treated. There's a clip of a police officer saying, you know, let us know if you need anything. Do you need any assistance? That kind of thing. And it is striking the way the Extinction Rebellion protests as well have similarly been treated. And we've had judges come out and say they support Extinction Rebellion in the middle of sentencing them for, you know, disruption. We've had the Met Police say, well, the cause is really important. I mean, what is going on there? Why are they treated like no other protesters, essentially?
Well, because their aims and their politics are like no other politics, because every single member of parliament, every, you know, almost sort of bar us and a few others, every political commentator will kind of just, you know, despite being a bit annoyed at the fact that Extinction Rebellion does all this ridiculous street theatre or that it's offshoots engage in these kind of like annoying protests, they always finish their sentence with, but of course, their message is right, but of course, important. We need to do something about the climate. emergency, not about climate change, about Extinction Rebellion's language, the climate emergency. Everyone's on their side. And so it would be really terrible for the police to look like they were cracking down on people in an optics way who were all about saving the planet. And it has to be said, you know, that the police didn't react like this to the Sarah Everard protests. They didn't react like this to Black Lives Matter's protests. They certainly didn't react like that to the Brexit protests when that was happening. I remember when, you know, talk about blocking the M25. I remember there was noise about lorry drivers blocking the M25 in favor of Brexit around the time of the delays. I remember there was, in a completely different political row, discussions about taxi drivers blocking roads in London over the LTNs. And throughout all those discussions, there's been very clear messages from the police and from politicians which say, if you dare to do this, do not dare, really hard line. If what you would expect police officers to do, there's this kind of weird, very bourgeois, very kind of cosseted relationship with the police that these protesters have, where it's meant to be that police officers are there to facilitate your kind of games on the N25. Yeah. That they're there to make sure that you don't what piss your pants when you're sat there, or end up with not have enough water, or don't get cold. That's not what a police officer's role is about. And it actually shows the lack of radical sentimentality among these people. Let's also remember that Insulate Britain's aims are to insulate houses. I mean,
who could be against that?
Like, you know, it really
the protest
is
in favour of double glazing. Yeah,
and if you look at the average age of some of these protesters, particularly on the M25, you understand why they're so upset. That's probably why the police don't want to manhandle.
Yeah, yeah, and so you end up. Tom makes the crucial point, which is that if this was a mass movement, like as I've already mentioned, leaseholders asking for changes to their houses, and leaseholders asking, and you know, people who are stuck in places like the Grenfell Tower who are asking for some building regulations to be put in place. If it was linking with that, or tapping into some kind of other movement, maybe we're having a different discussion. But this is just eco dogma of the extreme, and it's pissing everyone off.
Yeah, I mean, it's street theatrics and obstructionism in the absence of any of that kind of popular support. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there was one YouGov ranking of charities and their popularity. Mm. And apparently, not only does Extinction Rebellion come near the bottom, but it's only just ahead of the EDL. So it tells you something about the level of popular support that movement has.
Absolutely. So Emma Raducanu stunned the world at the weekend by winning the US Open. She was the first qualifier to win a Grand Slam in history, and she did it without dropping a single set. But no sooner, even before she picked up the trophy, essentially, Twitter was on hand to remind us that she's an immigrant and that she's mixed race. Tom, what did you make of this response?
I thought it was really interesting. First of all, the uniformity of the response. It was like you know how every so often a WhatsApp message will go around a group of politicians and they all kind of tweet out a slightly tweaked version of the same message. It was exactly like that, but it was across the cultural set, the kind of leftish political class. You know, Adil Ray from GMB, Sadiq Khan got involved, various other people. And it was all just this essentially saying, she's an immigrant. Mm. Isn't that wonderful? She's dunked on all of these racists. Her prowess is fantastic. This is Britain, whatever. Now, on the one hand, you understand the sentiment somewhere in there. Mm. But at the same time, it's quite the cumulative effect of it is a young British woman achieves something absolutely incredible. And everyone stands up and says, she's an immigrant, you know.
Yeah.
Which to me is quite rude, and potentially a little bit racist. I mean, it's kind of interesting insofar as you have this identity politics, which because it wants to stress difference all of the time, because it constantly wants to virtue signal against what it perceives to be a racist blob in society, and constantly wanting to dunk on those kind of imagined bigoted masses, that it takes the form of constantly insisting on difference. Mm. And so therefore, not only do they just not see one of their fellow citizens succeeding, but they just, even the individual achievement gets completely crowded out. You know, it just becomes this kind of overly kind of exoticized kind of, this is a product of, you know, Romanian grit and Chinese hard work. Yeah, it almost kind of, you know, rehabilitates and quite kind of a strange process of just othering kind of ethnic minority Britons, of treating their successes not as something that are kind of universal, but are something which are very, very specific because of their very, very specific identity. And there's just no getting away from that. This tick that they have is to racialize, ultimately, even if there are, as they would see it, slightly better intentions involved in that, I guess.
Yeah, and there's always this sense that immigrants are exceptional, which I just find very strange because, you know, if I were to make a case for immigration, I would say, well, they're just like you or me. Mm. But I think one of the reasons that kind of tendency to kind of exceptionalize these immigrants comes out is because then you can contrast them with the, you know, the horrible natives, essentially. That seems to also be one of the drivers behind this celebration of immigration and diversity.
Yeah, and the funny thing about Raducanu is that it's also, even in their kind of othering of her, actually, which is what I think you're saying, and it's true, there's an awkwardness about it because of the fact that she has so openly talked about how proud she is of her Chinese heritage, which is doesn't sit well with lots of those same media commentators. I mean, she mentioned, she gave this speech and thanked everyone. She's huge now in China because she spoke in Mandarin and is kind of adding to her worldwide fame. But then she also said that she drew so much of her resilience and her self-discipline from her mother and from her. She kind of talked about the way in which people in China had a sense of never stopping and believing themselves. And words like that, that actually don't resonate with today's cultural set. So self-resilience is actually is a dirty word. Discipline is a dirty word. It's all about actually, as we've seen from the kind of fawning over Naomi Osaka or Simone Biles or any of these things that we've talked about on the podcast, it's all about celebrating your vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And here you have Emma Raducanu coming on and being amazing and saying, actually, it's because I have a sense of grit and I have a sense of what the importance of being kind of hard-nosed. And there's an inability to kind of deal with that as well. It's really depressing that identity gets used as this, especially with someone so young. If you're 18 and you're trying to think about what kind of person you are, you might think about yourself as someone from a nation, and particularly if you're a sports person, you would obviously think like that. But taking into account her mixed race heritage, taking into account the fact that she's also an 18-year-old that hasn't figured out who she is yet, really, apart from being now an international superstar in the sporting stage, it feels very wrong to try and pinhole her into something that you might particularly see her being throughout the rest of her life. She'll always be the immigrant tennis star. That feels very wrong for someone so young as well.
And also, as you were saying, Fraser, to just kind of use her success as just as if that makes the case for immigration for you is an incredibly curious thing to do. I mean, first of all, because it's ridiculous. I mean, this is an argument that you have to have out in society. If you want a more liberal approach to immigration, as we do, then you need to argue for it. You can't assume that people momentarily taking a like to a tennis player of immigrant background. I mean, see, you like them really, therefore it's fine. I mean, it's ridiculous when you think about it. But also, Raki Basal made this point on Spike this week, which is to kind of individualize the discussion in that way. It's actually playing a bit of a dangerous game.
Yeah.
Because if you just take individual immigrant success stories, if you like, as the kind of slam dunk argument for immigration, then you're going to have people on the far right who are going to use the kind of individual cases of immigrants in relation to questions of radicalization, in relation to this, in relation to crime or whatever. And again, try to extrapolate that in a way to try and turn people off the concepts. So rather than having a proper political discussion, you end up trading these kinds of ridiculous kind of statements. And that's something which is a dangerous road to go down.
Also the fact that just you want the Emma Raducanus to come as well, and their families. You also want the people who are, you know, talking about HGV drivers and skill shortages. You want people who are an average Joe who's never going to be a tennis star. There ends up being a discussion about good immigrants and bad immigrants.
We can't just have an immigration policy for future tennis stars. It would be ridiculous.
It's incredibly reductive.
You're listening to the Spiked podcast. If you're enjoying the show so far, why not give us a rating and a review? It really helps other like-minded people find the show. It's really easy to do. Just search for The Spike Podcast with whoever provides your podcast and give us a nice, generous 5 stars. Now, back to The Spike Podcast. So every year, the Met Gala always draws all the top celebrities and usually in some quite zany, allegedly fashionable outfits. This year, the outfit that caught the most attention belonged to Congresswoman AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was wearing a white flowy dress that said, "Tax the rich." I mean, Tom, the rich must have been quaking in their boots when they saw this, right?
Well, that's the way that she kind of tried to justify it, which I think was quite interesting. She made these comments to Vogue. It was something to the effect of saying, I wanted to enjoy the party, but also kind of put them a little bit at ease or whatever. Mm. And it's a ridiculous statement for two reasons. First of all, because at the Met Gala, at any of these kind of celebrity gatherings, they're all engaged in kind of very kind of platitudinous political statements.
Yeah.
You know, I forget who was walking around with the peg, the patriarch.
Cara Delevingne.
There you go. I mean, that was, you know, that's slightly more
she is an aristocrat as well.
Yeah.
Aristocratic background.
Slightly more ridiculous example, but nevertheless. they're very comfortable with this. They've also probably got tax affairs such that they wouldn't be touched by a high marginal tax rate in the US or anywhere else.
Allegedly.
At least some of them. But it's also interesting because it's a fundamentally unradical proposition in the first place. Just talking about you should pay your taxes. It's important, but it's not the be all and end all. The fact that she's held up as America's great radical political figure for making a statement like that is interesting. But it's also the fact that, again, this is not a kind of dangerous message. It's just something which can be easily... It's a kind of form of faux anti-capitalism that can just be so easily absorbed and consumed as pop culture and as by the kind of celebrity elite, if you like. You know, America's... You know, think of Tom Wolfe and Radical Chic, the kind of... That about high society cocktail parties in support of the Black Panthers and all the rest of it, and how you have the kind of American elite... using radical politics as a kind of fashion accessory. This is almost like a much more degraded form of that, because you have AOC, a much more less radical proposition to begin with, who is literally wearing her politics as a fashion accessory. Yeah. So it's even more degraded, it's even more kind of hollow. And I think whilst people are trying to lend some significance to this, trying to suggest that this was actually a great stand, it just speaks to how unthreatening that form of kind of faux left, but also quite identitarian, allegedly democratic socialist politics in the US is, and how easily it can sit amongst the mega rich and the celebrity set. It's really not a threat to any of those people in any way, shape, or form.
I mean, already, I suppose this is just us, but the biggest indication of that, because the way that AOC was already embraced by Vogue and the like, you know, it was a good indication that her politics were fundamentally not very threatening. Ella?
Yeah, well, there's this weird sort of disconnect, or maybe it's not a disconnect. I think it is AOC's politics that she thinks this is the realm in which change happens. So she thinks, and the way in which she puts forward her supposedly left-wing views or radical views, is that if you make Hollywood stars or like rich people, whatever that means, uncomfortable, then you're doing something radical, then you're making change. And the crucial thing there is that, where is the public? Where are the people that she's supposed to be talking about or speaking on behalf of, or acting in the name of? They're at home watching and meant to applaud her. And that kind of disconnect between there being absolutely no normal people at the Met Gala other than all the staff who are there wearing masks while all the maskless, very pro-mask celebrities are wandering around kissing each other and doing interviews. There is no normal life there. And so the extent to which it can be anything other than a stunt that really actually just reifies the status quo there's no potential for it there. I mean, Tom's point about it being a fashion accessory, I mean, we've seen, and we've covered it on Spiked for many years now, that the political statement has become the clutch bag of the award ceremony.
Yeah.
I mean, right back in the kind of, I was thinking back through all the different expressions there have been, and I remembered the Time's Up pins from 2018, which is a perfect example. I mean, it was a bit like the world is on fire from Extinction Rebellion. It was like, time's up for the women's movement, you know, something has to be done. And then the pins get thrown in with the suit back to the dry cleaner and no one remembers anything about it.
Yeah.
There's a real disposable nature to these political statements. I'm sure that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will dine out on this on Instagram for about a week, but then what will happen? And actually, not, you know, it's tax. Who is interested in tax, really, in the grand scheme of radical politics? I mean, Jesus. The whole thing is a kind of shows what a pantomime so much of the Democrats' radicalism is, and how depressing it is actually for ordinary people watching it, who most of us just want to see some pretty gowns. That's what the Met Gala is about. It's about costume. And we're not particularly interested in having political, lame political messages shoved down our throats.
Tax bureaucrats of the world unite.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday, and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.